That's the wonderful part of this, is as we get into this and begin to share it together, I also, Cheryl brought a book that she's been reading that deals with some of the theological questions that we raised last night. It's called Starting Over Single. Deals with divorce and church. There are a couple chapters on church and scripture. Okay, what I wanted to do then to start with this morning is to start with a ritual. I thought of starting with a ritual last night. But a part of the view of ritual, after we did Vespers last night, I didn't feel like we needed to do anything different than what we did, because that was such a beautiful service in itself. And I'm very much a creation spiritualist, believing that in our intellectual-oriented society, we have ignored the power of spirit in earth and being around us. And so I've done some training with Matthew Fox and been to several other kinds of schools of spirituality. And I am really touched by understanding the power and the beauty of native spiritualities. Spiritualities that are very, very sensuous spiritualities that really see and draw us together in the reflection of the universe itself as a blessing rather than as some kind of evil that we must avoid. So a part of the spiritual presence this morning is a way of being able to say, and this is one of the beautiful thoughts, in the Native American culture says that whenever people are gathered together, and that's why they do almost everything in a circle, and why I like this room, they believe that whenever their tribe or community or family is drawn together, that where they are drawn together in the center of that circle is the center of the universe. That all of the energy of the universe is drawn here to be with us this weekend. And so the rituals that they use to start are rituals of blessing and affirmation, of invoking and calling forth those spiritual energies. It's like a mutual acknowledgement. You acknowledge the energies in the spirit of the universe, that energy will be here with you. So I have the four candles here. Now you have to help me, staff people. What are the directions? Is this north? That's Irish. That wasn't so far off. I assume this is north. So this would be north here. That's south. That would make this west here, and this is east. Okay. It's not too bad. So let me walk around the circle. And you might take a moment to go ahead and put everything down for a moment. And to allow yourself to become centered. Allow yourself to just sit quietly. To meditate and to be able to go into your being, into your inner self. The universe doesn't speak to us in our mental distractions. Instead, the universe speaks to us softly and quietly. As one of the great spiritual masters of the 14th century said, God is forever hiding from us, whispering and trying to let us know so that we can see him. Our responsibility is to learn to be silent, to learn to listen with obedience and discipline. So go into yourself and be still. Quiet your mind and body. Close your eyes if that will help. Feel and be aware of your breathing, the rise and the fall of your chest. Be aware that without conscious thought, how the universe sustains you in your breath, maintaining the life source, and how your body accommodates that life source with its natural breathing. Be still, go deeper, be quiet. Acknowledge any distractions that you might hear around. Allow them to come into your consciousness and then let them go away, so that you know you are centered. And as you experience your stillness, you experience the miraculous blessing of being that the universe has evolved itself to this molecular creativity that is you, a density of molecules and atoms and photons, pieces of sunlight that you are. A density that is known nowhere else in the universe but in the human species. Be still and know that you are a blessing, and all of the creative powers and energies of the universe are here with you. If your mind wanders in distractions of what has come before, allow those thoughts to come in, their normal intrusions, and allow them to go away. If you are preoccupied with things to come, acknowledge your preoccupations, welcome them, and then say goodbye and let them go on their way. And be present as we call forth the powers of the universe. And from the east, the dawning of the day, the spring of our time. And from the west, the ruler of emotions and feelings and love and courage and daring, sorrow, the tides, the lakes, the oceans, the streams and rivers, springs and wells, we invoke the unconscious and the intuition, the womb of generation and fertility. From the north, we bless the earth and invite the body and growth and nature and sustenance, creativity, birth, death, silence, chasms, caves, caverns, groves, fields, rocks, standing stones, mountains, crystals. We invite your power and energy. And to this place, this center of the universe, where there is spirit and circumference throughout and about, we invite the power of transcendence and transformation, change, a center that is everywhere and nowhere, within and without. We invite you, Father, Mother, Spirit, Jesus, that you would be with us and bless us in this time of search, in this time of questioning. Into your being the energy of the universe, and know that you are special and you have a right to be here, that you deserve all that is here available to you, the companionship, the compassion, the learning, knowledge, the playfulness, the joy, the emotions and feelings, this is your time. It was designed for you. Cherish it. Acknowledge it. Welcome it. Now take a deep breath in. And blow it out gently. To return to consciousness, to return to this place, in this room, take a deep breath in. And blow it out gently. One more and we'll open our eyes. Deep breath in. And blow it out gently. And take your time to open your eyes to come back. Just think of that. Again, it's very symbolic and it's a spiritual awakening, but it's a place and a time. In essence, what we're doing in this kind of ritual is we are making this a sacred place. We're making this a place so that if you need time for reflection and thought about things that you hear and see, then allow yourself to come here and be aware of the symbol of the candles. And be aware of your ability to be here in your stillness and quiet and to draw the power of the universe to you. So let this be a sacred place. And when we eat over here. And when we go play out here. But this can be your place of quiet, your place of celebration, your place of ritual. And it's important that we know that when we come together, we make this our sacred place. It allows us to be still. It allows us to honor this place and honor one another in the process. Okay, this morning, the focus is going to be on grief and loss and alienation. And the kind of a subtitle that I give to this section of the retreat is understanding that parents are people first. And that we oftentimes get so preoccupied and caught up in the responsibilities that are given to us and roles that we play. And we tend to forget and ignore that as human beings, when we bring a child into the world or we have the responsibility of a child, what we are first, before we are any set of techniques and rules, is that we are a living model. We are a living example to our children of what it means to be alive. And that children, because the first years of their life is nonverbal, that those first years and those first messages and lessons are learned by experience. They learn by how we handle life. And that is what is most essential. And that we are able to somehow model and exemplify for them. So what that often means is first we have to begin to address what is lost, or what is limited, or what is frozen deep within ourselves. Now, last night I talked about delusionment and the romanticism, disillusionment, and despair as a part of the relationship cycle. The way that we respond to that relationship cycle, and our primary response to that is feelings.
Yes, I got a new black one.
Oh, good. Sure, Jack. No, it's probably just working. Getting the ink. There we go. feelings. Feelings are this body image, this body self that reacts and responds to the world around us. What happens to us as a culture is that we are not taught how to be and to live in our feelings. Conflict, chaos, loss, separation, destruction, change, those are all normal phenomena in our lives. And feelings are the normal response, the way that our physical being reacts to the physical phenomenon and reality of the environment and the earth around us. Our responsibility to be healthy is our capacity and ability to know, to listen, to acknowledge our feelings, and to find the healthy ways to use the experience to allow those feelings to teach us what is it that I am being called to? What am I to learn? What am I to go? Where am I to go? How do I respond? Unfortunately, what is saddest in our culture is that we are not taught to feel. We are taught to ignore. In this male-dominated culture, you know, in a Western civilization, traditional thinking that has been predominantly intellectual-oriented, seeking for the highest truth and wisdom, we have ignored our greatest resource, our body. So we have developed, you know, a lot of this intellectual genius in terms of the sophisticated advances in intellectual understanding. But what we have tended to ignore is how to utilize all of that information we have and to validate it through our bodies, because this is our connectedness to reality. It's wonderful that you have this tremendous intellectual capacity. See, and it's wonderful that we have this incredibly amazing world that we live in. But what we tend to forget is that this is the primary conduit, the primary resource for our relationship to that world and to this consciousness, this ability to think and abstract and reflect. And when we take out the primary conduit, what we do is we have left out the essential tool. And so one of the issues that we deal with when we talk about grief is related to feelings. Grief is related to acknowledging and understanding and knowing the process by which I experience change, destruction, stress, conflict, and that I am able to learn from this resource, my body. That I am able to learn from this resource what is it that this conflict, change, death is trying to teach me? What is the lesson that is there available for me to myself? Well, that would be wonderful if it were all natural and healthy, but in our culture, what we don't deal with in feelings is our grief. And so what we do is we adapt. And adapting means basically, if I am not able to be fully in myself, in my being, to experience life, and I do not trust my own inner instincts, and I don't validate myself and my being, what I then begin to do is try to adapt myself to the environment, to somehow survive. So I go from a level of power and confidence and clarity to a level of survival. And usually what underlies that is terror and fear. The fear that if I don't adapt fast enough, I will either fall behind, I will be rejected, I will be abandoned. Or that if I don't do it right, I will be guilty. or I will be shameful. Well, that first level of adapting that we call in our culture is the first stage of grief. Denial. Denial is about the inability to acknowledge and validate what is true, what is real and valid. Now, we do denial by a number of things. Culturally, what our culture tells us, and we are taught at a very early age, back into our own childhood. For example, men are often taught that big boys don't cry. So men are taught to repress sadness or scare. The only emotion that's acceptable in our culture as a whole for men is anger. We can get out on a sports field and beat the hell out of each other. That's acceptable. It's not acceptable for us to show affection and love. It's not affection for us to be scared. And it's especially not accepted for us to show sadness, to show tear, because in a competitive-oriented society, that's a sign of weakness. So there were all of those messages when we were children about children should be seen and not heard. Keep a stiff upper lip. Put your best face forward. Big boys don't cry. Don't cry, or I'll give you something to cry about. Get out of my way. I don't have time for you now. So I want you to hear these messages, because unconsciously, these are some of the very same things that we do to our children. Because there are things that we took in physically that affected our very esteem, our very belief about ourselves. And so what happens is, when we are in stressful situations, in spite of all the knowledge that we might know about healthy parenting skills, when we're stressed out, what we end up doing is doing the thing that's most familiar to us. And what's more familiar than all those learned messages is the unconscious learning inside. So if we were told to get away from them because they bothered us, if we were ignored a lot because our parents were preoccupied, what more than likely will happen is that we will model that same preoccupation with our children. We will be too busy. But when they come up and ask us questions, we will be distracted, staring at a TV or preoccupied with some other level of busyness. And we won't take the time to turn to our children and say, I hear you, and I see you. What is your need? I acknowledge your presence. I may be busy right now, and I will be back to you. See, and a lot of that is because in our denial, we push things back in. Now, denial happens in a number of ways. Feelings-wise, because feeling is an energy inside of ourselves, one of the things that we do is to know that a part of our feeling energy is to literally go numb inside of ourselves. It means that we learn to develop a tolerance to pain. So maybe one of the messages you heard as a child is, stop overreacting. You're much too emotional. Don't be so sensitive. You're making mountains out of molehills. Okay, remember some of those messages? Okay. So when you hear those kinds of messages, what you literally learn is to doubt your own being. So when your body reacts in a way that it is angry or sad or scared, but you have those constant messages of you're making mountains out of molehills and stop making a big to-do out of things, then what you begin to do is you begin to numb those feelings. You begin to stop trusting. And eventually what happens is you learn not to feel. You develop a high tolerance to pain, because your adapting thinking says, well, if I need love and acceptance from these people, then what I need to do is not raise a ruckus, because they always get mad at me if I get mad, so what I'll do is I'll stop getting mad. And the only way that I can stop getting mad is to stop feeling. I stop feeling my mad. And so what I'll do is, if I get irritated, I'll pout, or I'll go inside. Or if I get mad, I'll just stomp away, or I'll take it out on something or someone else. So what literally happens is that we begin to numb. We develop an increased tolerance to pain. What we don't understand, it was those messages that were inaccurate. It was not our feelings that are inaccurate. We have a right to our anger. We have always had a right to our anger. Unfortunately, generations before us have never known how to deal with our anger. Picture this. What would you do if there were a two-year-old who came here right in the middle of this session, lay right down here on the floor and started flopping around throwing a temper tantrum? See, for two-year-olds, what they used to call the terrible twos, that's an important time of learning power. Throwing tantrums is healthy. Because one of the greatest fears that we as human beings have is a fear about anger. And one of our fears about anger is that if I get into a rage, I will be so uncontrolled that I will do damage to myself or somebody else. Our fear is that if I lose it, I might kill somebody, or I might, you know, invoke somebody to kill me. And that's because we have repressed our ability to express anger. And developmentally, what a child needs to learn from those very earliest stages of their life is that they have a right to their feelings. And one of the ways that children learn boundaries is for them to throw a temper tantrum, to flop around on the floor, and to have the parent say, "Go for it. All I want to do is keep you safe. It's not okay for you to hurt yourself or to destroy anything else, but you can flop around all you want." See, because then what the child will learn very quickly is that anger is a temporary emotion, because they won't be able to keep up that energy for very long. They get real tired. And the other part of it is that if nobody's reacting to them, and that they don't discover that there's a whole lot of power in their anger other than they get physically tired, then they stop doing it after a while. Initially, they'll try to do it to say, "Well, if I can't do it this way, let me see if this works. Will you pay attention to me?" Even if it's negative attention, at least it's, "Well, I got your concentration now." But if you let them do what it is they need to do, know that they need to be safe, and you clarify the boundaries with them, eventually they get tired, so they get up and they walk away and go do something else, because that didn't work. But the other thing they discover is that anger is normal, that anger is an acceptable emotion, and so they're able to express themselves, and that anger has boundaries and limits, that it doesn't go on forever. For many of us adults, we're terrified of anger because we're afraid that it's going to go on forever, or if I get real angry that people reject me and go away from me, which may have been the messages that our parents gave to us, because we may have been punished for being angry. Anger is normal. Anger is healthy. Now, in the grief process in our culture, what we have a tendency to do in this culture is not deal with anger in a healthy way. Instead of acknowledging, remember that, and this is a key thing about feelings, our feelings are for us. They're not for anybody else. Something somebody does might evoke a feeling inside of me, but the feeling is for my learning. But what tends to happen in our culture is, rather than acknowledging that when I have feelings that they're there for me, the tendency in our culture is to somehow want to react back. And so what we have a tendency to do is to, there are two directions we tend to do. Is one, we either explode outwardly to try to use our rage to control the environment. So we have this rageful explosion, or we'll turn it inwardly on ourselves, and that's called depression. Okay. Depression is another part of the grief process. Now let's talk for a moment about anger that's exploded out. There was a study done a number of years ago by New York Life. They went out and studied what they called typical healthy American families. Which meant, I don't know what it meant specific, Yeah, where were they? But by their standards, they were just simply looking for an intact family that had no divorce, no alcoholism in it. And they, and when they studied these families, all they did was they had 1,000 families, and they studied the number of positive comments versus the number of negative comments. Okay. What they found in the average American family is the negative comments outnumbered the positive comments 15 to 1. See, so what I'm saying to you, that frozenness in grief often means, see, feelings, and these are all normal things, but what happens is when we get stuck in these things, they become destructive. It's not feelings that are unhealthy, it's what we do with the feeling. So the axiom is, if you don't learn healthy ways to deal with your anger, then your anger will deal with you. It will come out in abusive, destructive ways. One of the ways that we have a tendency to deal with anger is through projection. Perhaps one of the most familiar and common American traits is put-downs, criticism, righteousness, name calling, in other words, many times what we do is, rather than being able to say, when you did such and such, it made me angry, instead what we often experience is, well, that was stupid. What's the matter, dummy? Can't you figure it out? You're such an idiot sometimes. Now, how many of you can think of other kinds of ways that you've heard anger expressed? Not in honest anger, but in some kind of judgment, some kind of put down, some kind of criticism. Can you acknowledge those things? Okay. See, and what that literally does, it's an attempt to somehow take the emotion inside, deny that it belongs to me, and project it out into the environment. So that if I can demean the environment, then maybe I don't have to feel responsibility for how, for my own feeling. I don't have to take responsibility for it. So we as a culture, when men are terrified and afraid of women, what men do is they sexualize women, put them down. And that's what a lot of what the women's liberation movement has always been about, the sexist language in the church. Sexist language in the culture, because we have literally taken something which for the male-dominated culture traditionally has been a fear of women. Men are scared to death of women, whether they want to admit it or not. And so what they did was, rather than acknowledge that they're scared and get into a dialogue with women to see that we have a lot in common and a lot to teach one another, instead, what they did is they created very rigid stereotypes. You know, so we make a lot of those rigid expectations of, well, a woman's place is in the home, and she keep her barefoot and pregnant, and, you know, well, they're all dizzy blondes anyway, and, you know, they can't think straight, and they're not responsible, and they're not capable of doing what a man's capable of doing. And the list can go on and on and on and on about ways culturally men have put down women. It's an anger. What's underneath that anger is terror. Men are as equally oppressed, but the first reality is that we have to deal with the projection. The same kind of rigid stereotyping happens for men. Men have to be tall, dark, and handsome. You know, strong macho types. Men are silent. Men are emotional. Men are supposed to be sexually aggressive. Men are supposed to be breadwinners. Men are supposed to be competitive. Men are supposed to be you know, fighting for number one. Men are supposed to be in the business place. And so what happens is men get put into categories. Categories that are literally projections of anger. And so what happens is oftentimes in relationships, we are literally trying to project our stereotype. When men and women get together, more often than not, what we are doing is projecting our own inadequacies and our own deepest fears into someone else and hoping that they'll fulfill our role. They'll fill for us what we wish, what we don't know how to do for ourselves. And then, of course, when you get into the romantic game, you get guys and gals who get together and they try to fulfill each other's romantic fantasies. But once the romance begins to wear off and you get tired of trying to do that thing, then you get angry at each other. And that's where a lot of conflict in marriage and in relationships happen, is trying to acknowledge that it's that I can't possibly live up to your terror and fear and what your needs are. I can't fulfill for you. Now, another way that anger tends to come out in our culture in rage is abuse. And we find that there's just a tremendous amount of physical. This is a lot of emotional abuse. But the other ways we find it is physical abuse, sexual abuse. See, when we have rigid stereotypes of people, that what that means is we desensitize ourselves. I want you to hear that word, desensitize, meaning that we have literally numbed our body. We have literally numbed our body to ourselves and to other people. And when we projected that anger out on other people, then what that does is it gives us permission in our own delusional thinking. It gives us permission, if I'm numbed and I'm angry at somebody, that I have a right to abuse them. So I have a right to push them around. I have a right to criticize them. I have a right to demean them. So I have a right to call them a whore, a slut, or a bitch, or a bastard, or an asshole, or, you know, and if you notice that a lot of the male-female put-downs are sexually related. That what we try to do is attack somebody's sexuality. And then if we have decided in our own mind that this person is a bitch, then I don't have to treat her with respect. If you've decided in your mind that this guy is a bastard, see, you've given yourself permission to, now I can demean this person because they are less than human, they are less than respectable to myself. And so what we do is we try to literally desensitize ourselves to each other, which literally then gives us permission to be aggressive. To be aggressive, to outwardly go out and to seek ways of undermining, hurting, abusing, neglecting, rejecting that person, and doing it in a heartless way because we've set up this process in our mind. And this kind of anger, unhealthy anger, is often what we call aggression, aggressive anger. Aggression is going out of myself in some activity or behavior that has the intent and the power to coerce, to control, to manipulate another human being to do my will. That's what aggression is. So whenever I've done something with the intent of putting down, demeaning, getting over on another person, I've been aggressive to them. And that's the basis of abuse. Abuse is defined as a power differential. When somebody does something to another human being against their will, that's called abuse. That's the definition of abuse in our culture. So frozen grief, when it gets into anger, is a way that tends to be preoccupied. It's one of the reasons that we say, there was in my doctoral program, there was a woman who was a genius. Her name was Joan O'Hanisson. She's written several superb books on women in the church and on sexuality. But she used a symbol that I really like. She says, that's why this anger, frozen anger, is why the American church and the American people are so preoccupied with professional sports. You know, because professional sports are the arenas where we get people together in a highly competitive way, and we love to watch them beat the hell out of each other. You know, and so we project our want into these players. That's why they can make astronomical salaries, because all they're going to say is, I don't want to do it anymore, and we've lost our heroes. So they ask for a couple more million a year. But what her analogy was is, if you ever go to a sports stadium and watch professional sport, what you'll see, like in a football game, is 22 players on the field badly in need of some rest, and 65,000 people in the stands badly in need of some exercise. See, that the people are vicariously living their aggressions through the sports players. Now, the other direction is anger turned inward. And that's called depression. For many of us, we don't have the confidence to project out. And because of our tradition of Christian value of love your neighbor, for many of us who are fearful of being abandoned and rejected and wanting to find some semblance of acceptance, that our adapting is not to be chaotic or aggressive or explosive, but rather when we adapt ourselves is that we become very passive. And what happens when we get passive is that we want to take our energy that we feel, but we don't want to put it out there for fear that it might abandon us, that people might abandon us. So what we do is we take all of this energy in our body and we turn it in on ourselves. And so the way that we get passive, the characteristics of passivity and depression are, one, that we begin to discount ourselves. So we take all these concepts and put downs, and rather than projecting them out there, we put them on ourselves. Well, I didn't deserve it. You know, you made your bed, you got to sleep in it. I'm a failure. I'm a sinner. I'm inadequate as a human being. I don't deserve it. It's too hard. So literally, what happens is, and what depression is about, is the taking of an energy. You know, a normal spiritual vitality, because we are energy fields. We are pure light and pure energy, but we literally take that light and that energy within us and we try to push it down. We try to push it down and hold it. So we don't communicate this energy, because when conflict happens, conflict is an invitation to grow. It's a challenge to change. It's a challenge to acknowledge. But what depression is about is that we take that energy and we literally push it. We literally try to stuff it down inside of ourselves. So one of the ways that we do that is by perpetual discounts, self-discounts. I don't deserve, I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough. And so what happens is that one of the physical signs of depression is we become tired. Physically tired. We don't have the energy to put out into the world outside of us. We've got so much energy inside. Now, the next thing is, a lot of people say, well, a tired, depressed person doesn't have much on their mind. But what we find is exactly the opposite is true. That a depressed person is constantly mentally preoccupied. Meaning that we're in a constant state of trying to figure everything out. We've discounted our feelings. And so now what begins to happen is, in order to try to adapt, we go into hyperspeed. Figuring everything out. We try to stay one step ahead of people. We get a sense of hypervigilance. Have you ever kind of wandered into a room and kind of scanned the room to kind of see what the mood of the room was, so that you could adapt your personality to know how to react to whoever was there. It's kind of like as a kid. If you're excited about something, but your parents have been real erratic and inconsistent, then what you do as a kid is you walk in the house and kind of check out. Is it okay to ask for something now, or should I keep my mouth shut and go back and turn on my stereo? You know, because if they're in a nasty mood, if I ask, I know I'm going to get rejected. So what I learned to adapt is to push everything inside. And so what happens is that I literally become, very preoccupied with the external world. Very preoccupied with the external world. You know, in the field that we deal with all the time, this is a lot of what codependence is about. The experience of codependence is an adaptability. It's a survival mechanism. It's a way that I try to get... I don't trust my own being, and I don't trust my own power, so I become preoccupied with the external, and I'm working 1,000 miles an hour trying to figure out what do they want out there so I can adapt myself to figure out how to be accepted out there. But ultimately what happens is this mental preoccupation drives us insane. Next consequence of depression is a low self-esteem. Because I'm putting all my energy into trying to figure out the environment, and whatever I do, it's never quite enough. So I always feel somehow inadequate. I always feel somehow left out or unimportant. In order to not be rejected, I become very, very self-critical. So I judge myself very harshly, figuring that if I judge myself harshly, then they won't have to do it to me, because I've already figured that out about myself. Can you see how this energy is exhausting? Literally exhausting. Then what also begins to happen is this. Once I have a low self-esteem, then literally what happens is our soul or our spirit hides. It retreats to the furthest corners of our unconscious being. It literally covers itself, so we don't have a light inside anymore. So now what happens is we become obsessed and compulsive to seek out a way to somehow fill the void or the emptiness that we feel inside. So we may, and it's not unusual for depressed people to have eating disorders, that they get into food as a way to try to fill their needs. Or they get into compulsive sexual relationships, the need to somebody find Mr. Right or Miss Right, or at least somebody who will make me feel good about myself. Or we get into an obsession about things, so we're preoccupied with shopping and spending money and wearing the right jeans or driving the right car or getting the right college education. We get obsessed with power. We get obsessed with, TV, stereos, living vicariously through soap opera characters, because my spirit has died, so maybe I can experience my aliveness through, soap opera characters, or I can get into music and just listening to stereos and drown my sorrows in music. There are 1,001 ways that we get obsessed and compulsed. And what you experience here is a preoccupied energy. Henry Nouwen uses the word that my thinking becomes absurd. Okay? And what he says is that the word absurd comes from the word surdus. And the word surdus means I become deaf. I am not able to hear and listen to my feelings. That's what happens in obsessional behavior. That I have lost touch with my being, with my spirit, with my soul, inside of myself. And so when I have lost touch with this part of myself, I literally begin to die inside. Okay, impressions, feelings, thoughts, is this making sense to you?
I'm feeling a lot of confusion now with all this, I'm just wondering, is that the
Sure. A lot of what happens when we become mentally preoccupied is we do become confused. And a lot of what that confusion is about is that my mind is perpetually scanning the environment to try to figure everything out, but I've lost touch with here, and I don't trust my being. So it's like I'm taking in all this information, but I have nowhere to go with it. No way to validate it. I don't know what's right or wrong or good or bad. So I become real hyper because I become paranoid to make a decision. I become terrified to try to make a decision because then I'm afraid that no matter, because my esteem says to me, it doesn't matter what decision you're going to make, it's not going to be right anyway. See, and the tendency in our civilization is because we are so outwardly conscious, because we have lost touch with our inward selves, because we are so outwardly conscious, we put all our eggs in one basket. So we want to say that for me to believe in myself, that my marriage has to work. Okay? Not that our marriage is a relationship, you know, it's an intense, intimate commitment with another human being that is a reflection that teaches us a lot about who we are. And a lot of what marriage is about is teaching us our limits as well as our benefits and capacities. But the tendency is that we want to put all the power in the marriage. I got to make the marriage work. Instead of understanding what the marriage is trying to teach us about what's working or not working within ourselves. And what we need for ourselves to be healthy. And it becomes doubly difficult when there are two people who are struggling with the same concept inside of themselves. See, so a lot of the confusion is that we're too preoccupied with trying to figure out what's right out here. There is no right or wrong out there. There are only choices. And the choices out there bring their own natural consequence. And it's learning to listen to those consequences and feel and allowing ourselves a normal grieving in this consequence that we begin the process of really healing and understanding and transforming. And then we can transform and validate and value all of our experience and forgive the pain. See, the Christian tradition says a lot about forgive your neighbor and forgive yourself. See, and those are wonderful values, but we have never been taught the mechanism of how do we get to that point of forgiveness. We just assume that if you learn it, you should be able to do it. But the reality is we spend all of our time being stuck up here. Because it's only been in the last 20 years that we've even begun to address this phenomenon called grief. Which is the way that we finally begun to acknowledge that the whole death-resurrection cycle is that we have to pay attention to our death process. That it can be transformed, we can be healed and forgiven, we can experience a new way of living. But we can't just say, because I'm a good Christian, I forgive you when I'm angry as hell. Because the first part of the step is I got to know how to go through my anger in a healthy way instead of letting it be aggressive and destructive or taking it into myself and burning myself up inside.
The word that's coming up for me is trusting, learning to trust those feelings.
Right, that's why this is important to learn, that we have to trust us first. You can't trust a marriage or you can't trust a church or anything else. It has to start here. If I don't have vitality and trust in my being first, then I am not able to experience it anywhere, whether in a marriage, in a church, in a community, in a job, that it has to come from in here first. Okay, what I would like you to do at this point, in the second half we're going to come back and talk about walking through this stage, and we're going to do a group exercise in the second half of this. But what I would like you to do is, it's 10 o'clock right now, Holden time. And I would like you to spend, we go to 10:30. So what I would like you to spend is, I want you to spend 10 minutes anywhere in the room, and you can kind of spread out around the room anywhere you would like. And I would like you to take some time to reflect on this as it applies to you. What are the ways that you sense that you have been in denial? That you have ignored things, minimized things, kind of got delusional or just kind of stay in any fantasy vision about things? What are ways that you acknowledge? And what I'm asking you to do is to think about how concretely you have become angry or aggressive, and that you are stuck in your anger or aggressiveness. So ways that you project out to other people, physical things that you do in anger to hurt yourself or to hurt other people, ways that you have been abusive. I want you to think about depression, these kind of characteristics, and literally write down for yourself the ways that you recognize passivity in your life, ways that you don't trust yourself, ways that you become tired or discount yourself or put yourself down. You take all these abusive things but turn it in on yourself. Ways that you say, I can't handle this. Ways that I get confused or obsessive or compulsive behaviors, that rather than dealing with situations, I go eat or I go get I drink or drug or look for somebody else to have sex with, or I just get preoccupied with whatever kind of thing that is not directly dealing with my feelings. So I want to ask you to reflect on that so that you can start naming and identifying some of those things with each other. And then I want to spend another 10 minutes where we'll get together in groups of four, where we might be able to start sharing with each other. Because one of the biggest scares is that if I identify and name all of these things that I do, that if people saw the list that I have, they would think I was a disgusting human being. And the reality is what you're going to experience is when you share them with each other, you all sit around with each other, nod your head and say, yeah, I've done that. Yeah, I've done that before. You need to know that this is normal. That this is a part of who we are as human beings. And that, you know, the only limitation here is not knowing how to get through this. So take 10 minutes and spend some time and reflect upon your grief. Where are you stuck in your feelings? And how does your grief come out of you for you? Any questions about that? Is that clear, what I'm asking people to do? So be by yourself, whether you want to just sit in your chair or you want to spread yourself out around the room a little bit, go ahead and take the time to do that. What I would like you to do is be able to just share about yourself. Being able to say, what I discovered about myself was I go into denial by numbing myself in these ways, and I'd like you to share what you discovered about yourself, what you've reflected on, ways that you numb, or when I get angry, I get stuck in my anger by projecting or becoming aggressive and list things that you do or share the things that you do, ways that you get stuck in anger, or I get stuck in my grief through depression when I enlist out and share the behaviors or share the ways that you notice that you discount or you become physically tired or mentally preoccupied or put yourself down, have a poor self-esteem, compulsions that you might have, addictions that you might have. So what I want you to do in this time is take a few moments just to be able to share with each other an awareness, your awareness about yourself. Is that clear? Okay. Go ahead.
We all have lots of things in common.
Yeah.
We all could relate to most of what you have on the board.
I feel all right saying all the feelings.
So it was okay for you to be able to express.
Nobody rejected.
Right.
And that I knew how to see those things in other, that I, when you asked us to go away and think about ourselves, I had already gone through and decided that those are all things that my mate has.
There you go. Yeah, I could see that too.
There was a hopefulness.
Pardon?
There was a lot of hopefulness, you know, that
out of that numb state, coming out of that intellectual state, just to realize that it's going to happen, you know, that there is a process there that happens, and it doesn't have to be one way or the other, and there's no measurement. It's just okay for it to flow.
I guess as I've been going through some of these, that now I'm having to deal with especially a lot of guilt because my children are 16 and 8, and like right now I think I have really emotionally abused them in the past, and so because of where I was, so now I'm having to, you know, it's pretty awful thinking about, now that I've become more aware, which is really neat, I'm more aware of what I've done to them. And that's really tough.
Thank you for sharing that. I hear that, and we will address that.
I come at that from another way, because I feel like a lot of this is a legacy that my parents gave to me, mm-hmm. through their own denial, and I'm incredibly angry. I don't know what to do with that anger. It's like, I try to talk to my parents about it, and they say, Susan, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, I said, so now what do I do?
Right. We'll begin to talk about that.
I'd like to say, though, that after the anger, it can't pass. And that you just go on with your life and you make it how you want it to
be. There are some very important specific learnings that we must all go through, and this is a part of, you know, I think your word legacy is really a valid one, that we have been passed down a legacy of experiencing and being victims of other people's denial or other people's frozen grief, as well as our own. But the other part of the legacy is that there has never been a healthy, helpful tool, and that's what makes it so hard, because when we try to return and want to go back and get things done, we turn back to people who are still blind or still stuck or still frozen. And so we perpetually get frustrated time and time and time again and re-experience the abandonment. And I'm going to be talking about that in the next segment of this morning's